So after all of that, I should introduce myself. I'm Lori Bergen, and I'm the founding dean of the new College of Media Communication and Information at CU Boulder. And it's really my pleasure to be here today on a topic that's an exciting one for all of us. Our speaker today is Chris Leonards, and she is the 19th superintendent of the Grand Canyon National Park, truly the crown jewel of America's national park system. Chris is not a stranger to Colorado. She grew up just down the road from us in Littleton, and she's explored much of the state with her family. In fact, I heard that her first visit to a national park was when she was about 5 years old, and her family went to see the cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde in southeast or southwest Colorado. I also know that Chris's dad was a geologist, and he loved the outdoors, and her family would travel a lot. She was quoted in an article about her travels that she said about her dad, he was always taking the family out someplace in Colorado with his geologist pick in one hand and his magnifying lens in the other, while her mom was rounding up the kids and making sure they didn't fall off any cliffs. So, not being a stranger to Colorado, she's also no stranger to our campus. Chris graduated from CU Boulder in 1985 with a degree in biology, and we're really delighted to have you here today. So, would you please welcome Chris Leonards.
Thanks, Lori. And one of the things that we need to do is have lunch sometime, because communication in parks is a big opportunity for us as well as a challenge. So thank you. Thank you for being here at 4 o'clock on a Monday when the hill is not that far away and opportunities for entertainment are abundant, as I understand. If they are now, they always will be if this is CU Boulder. So let's take a quick poll. Is there anyone here who's been to a national park? Go America. And so let's do the thing that I always hate to have to answer. So favorite parks. How about Yellowstone? Okay, we got super favorite, super fan. Grand Tetons National Park here in the Rockies. Yes, it is moose awesome. It is totally awesome. Grand Canyon National. Yes, okay. Cesar Chavez National Monument in Keene, California. New, right? Exactly. What about Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Park? Also new. It's actually a national monument. And the reason I ask is because often America thinks of national parks in a very traditional way. You know, the big outdoor landscapes that inspire us through their dark skies and their vast landscapes and the connections that we can make through nature. And indeed, that was the original thought around national parks, around conservation and around the preservation of our resources. So in 1861, Abraham Lincoln, in his inaugural address, one of the things we remember from his address in 1861 was his beseeching us to think about our better angels. How, as a nation, as a country divided, as a country on the brink of civil war, we could come together and be one and be united. And so that was something he spoke about in 1861. And the national parks were created in a time that came during that controversy. What was the first federal action to protect resources in the nation? 1864. It wasn't Yellowstone, not yet, but you're close. It was a land grant by Abraham Lincoln in 1864 to the state of California to protect those magnificent redwoods in Mariposa Grove, right? That is the first federal action that we took consciously and intentionally to say that these lands should be protected just of their own right for our inspiration. And then the first national park came along in 1872, which was Yellowstone National Park, created in 1872, world's first national park. Now, I was standing in the superintendent's residence. She was out of town, and so I was hosting a party on her behalf as the deputy superintendent, where the IUCN, the United Nations group that's around conservation, was meeting in Yellowstone to talk about conservation. And a woman from Australia came up to me, and she said, and I can't really do an Australian accent, but if I could, she'd say, "You only beat us by 6 months." So they had the second world's national park. But this idea of national parks and the fact that in a democracy we set them aside not for the rich and the wealthy and for development, but for the people, comes from the language in our Constitution, which is the people. There's a very specific meaning to that in our history. And if you go to Yellowstone and you look at the arch, there's an inscription there that says, set aside for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. And so in terms that Wallace Stegner used in 1863, national parks may be America's best idea. And he talked about them, he was a historian and writer, he talked about them as the best idea we ever had. He said, absolutely American, and probably they reflect our best selves. So a little bit of an echo of Abraham Lincoln there, almost 100 years later. So we fast forward to today, 2017. The National Park Service just celebrated its centennial as an organization. So while we had land grants and we had National Park created in 1872, we thought about parks in their own right as the heritage of America before we thought of a government organization to run them. Now, when does that happen, right? The thing came first, and then the government agency came second. And before the National Park Service was established, who was running national parks? There were about 15 or so, 15 or 20. The military. The cavalry arrived in Yellowstone in 1886 to protect the resources there, to stop the poaching, to protect the cultural resources. And so when you see a park ranger, not dressed like me, but dressed in the park ranger outfit, uniform, not outfit, sorry, that was my bad. When you see a park ranger dressed in that uniform, you see a military uniform. You see really what came from a military history. And the hat, everybody calls it a Smokey Bear hat, totally not Smokey Bear, not Smokey Bear, Park Service. And it actually came from Buffalo soldiers who wore their hats that way in the Spanish-American War. And they did it to keep the rain off themselves. They put what's called a Montana pinch in their hat. It has four peaks, the Montana peak hat. It's a military hat. Came directly from the wars over to Yellowstone and was worn by Buffalo soldiers who protected Yosemite, Sequoia, Kings Canyon, Yellowstone National Park. So it's this kind of truly forged in conflict time, right? Created in the Civil War, protected by the military, and is now a part of our consciousness as one of the most democratic of principles that Americans display. And that is everybody can get in. Follow a few rules. We do ask you to follow a few rules and occasionally pay a fee, but not that often. And it really goes to a good cause. We'll talk about that later. But just this idea that today we have 417 units of the National Park Service. And people sometimes say, oh, I bagged all the parks, which is really hard to do. But they're thinking of the 54 national parks, right? The big parks that were created early as scenic vistas. We also have battlefields, seashores, lake shores, waterways, national recreation areas, historical sites. There are about 18 different kinds of units that are America's heritage that are preserved by the National Park Service. So when you think about 417, we're thinking differently about national parks and our heritage today than we did at the turn of the century or in 1916. We're thinking about America's story as a bigger story. We think about America's story not just about the vast Western parks where people may have loaded up their Chevrolet to see the USA in the 1950s after World War II. We're thinking about who is America. And we're thinking about it in a way that tells the stories of all Americans. During President Obama's administration, he designated 29 national monuments, more than any other president. And those include places like Cesar Chavez, where we celebrate, memorialize, and honor the work of America's farm labor, the farm labor movement. Belmont Paul, where we talk about women's equality. Places that reflect more than just the mainstream culture of America. We also talk about parks as a place that's just at the end of your block. In 2016, when we celebrated our centennial, we had a tagline. It was called Find Your Park. And it didn't have to be a national park. It didn't have to be a national park. It's just a place that moved you. A place that connected you with your family or connected you with your friends or connected you with yourself. This idea that parks bring us comfort. Sometimes they bring us ritual. And they almost always bring us inspiration and memories. And so to me, when I think about the insider's scoop of America's national parks, I wonder what you think the inside scoop is. I got to Grand Canyon about 6 months ago. And so Grand Canyon, super amazing, right? It is immense. It reflects 6 million years of the Colorado River carving that country out there. It reflects rocks that are between 270 million years old and 1.8 billion years old. I mean, I can't even, what does that even mean, 1.8 billion years old? I was talking with a geologist last week from New Mexico State University, and he said that in the sedimentary rocks that they're studying at the Grand Canyon, they have found particles or sediments in some of those rocks that match the geology in Australia. Right? Sedimentary rocks happen because, you know, they get run over by water and they get carried along a stream and they run into each other and they get compacted and they become a sedimentary rock. And they can reflect different ages, the same rock. They date that rock based on how young the youngest particle is, because that particle had to happen before it became a rock. So Australia, how does that happen? Well, because the continents were in a different place. So the Grand Canyon was a receiving area for waters that came off of Australia. So there's a concept to learn about in a national park. So as I said, in 2016, we celebrated the centennial of the National Park Service as an organization, as a place that is held up as America's best idea, is held up as a conservation center for the world, for the international community around preservation and conservation of protected lands, and is a responsibility that all of us in the National Park Service are so happy to be able to fulfill and honored to be able to tell the stories about. So on January 1st of last year, we were at the Rose Bowl Parade. We were featured as Find Your Adventure, is what they called the Rose Bowl Parade. And then 3 weeks later, we had a report come out from the Office of Inspector General. And the Office of Inspector General had been investigating Grand Canyon National Park, and in particular the River District, which is the Colorado River. We had a unit of park employees who basically provided the research trips and science and law enforcement trips along the Colorado River, carrying only employees, no visitors, only employees. And the findings of the Inspector General was there was a long-term pattern of sexual harassment and hostile workplace that had been created on Colorado River in the River District. There were 12 women and one man who were declarants to the Secretary of Interior who said, "We've been sexually harassed or have witnessed sexual harassment on the river." When the Inspector General came to the park, they found 22 more individuals for a total of 35. Who reported over the course of about 15 years widespread sexual harassment and widespread workplace hostility. Now, mostly when I think of that, I really don't want to know, right? Because if I'm a person who enjoys parks, I just want to love the park. I just want to love the rangers who were there taking care of the park. And so when this came out in the public, it was a bit of a surprise, and it was only 3 weeks after the beginning of our centennial. And so 2016 was a mixed year for us. We had 11 billion media impressions, whatever that means, a lot, see? Super a lot, around the Find Your Park campaign, trying to get people to connect with the park who were millennials, people who weren't traditional visitors, people who didn't see their story told. And that was our highest purpose for 2016. But we also faced some things inside the National Park Service that were not very pretty. After the Grand Canyon report came out, another report came out about sexual harassment at Cape Canaveral. Our director was disciplined for an ethics violation. One of our regional directors was accused of and found essentially guilty of travel fraud. We had sexual harassment coming out all around the edges. And so what did that tell us? We spend a lot of time on our resources and on the public, and maybe not enough time with our workforce. So where we have to go as a National Park Service is to keep that part at the heart of our core, the heart of our mission to protect these places, to make sure the public has access to these places, to make sure our heritage is forever protected. We are in the forever business. But we can't ignore that the only way we accomplish our mission is through our people. And while for a long time we said, when you work for the Park Service, you get paid in sunsets, needs to be a little more than that. And so that's the journey that we're on really across the Park Service in this funny time in the world about women and sexual harassment and what's appropriate in the workplace or not appropriate or the values we have around that. we're really trying to put a stake down that says the most important thing for the workforce, for Grand Canyon, is that we're a respected and inclusive workforce. We're respectful, we're inclusive, that you can be safe in your job, you can feel secure, and you can find support. And I think if we change that, then we're going to have the perfect combination of the future. These parks are going to go forever. People of all varieties are going to want to come and work for the National Park Service because it touches our hearts and our minds. The consciousness of every person who comes through a park gate, walks down a trail, takes a canoe out on a lake. There's just something about that world where we create memories that connect deeply with our own individual DNA. So that's what I'm thinking tonight.
That's great. Would you like to take some questions now? Well, we have several questions that have already come in on the app. And while I'm reading several from here, if others of you want to submit them through virtual reality and technology, that's great. If you would rather write your question down on a note card, just wave your hand and we have folks in the back who will come and find you. But Chris, here's a question from a student. I'm a student interested and wondering if you've seen a lot of youth involvement in national parks and preservation. How do you think youth can get involved, not just elementary school students, but high school and college students as well?
So who's the student? Raise your hand. Where are you? Stand up. Where are you? Come on, don't be shy. Yes, a hand for you. You got, yes. So during 2016 in our centennial, one of the things our director told us was this is not a birthday party. This is not to look in the rearview mirror. And the goal of the centennial was to create and connect with the next generation of park visitors, supporters, and advocates. And that was the goal. And the things that we did were meant to change our connection with youth. Very specifically, a new program came out called Every Kid in a Park. And that gave every fourth grader in the nation a free pass to America's parks, which they were supposed to bring their family and friends, right? And we're doing it again this year. I haven't gotten my example pass, but we're hoping to do that for the next 10 years. So every fourth grader over the next 10 years is going to create this connection with public lands. But a connection with public lands isn't enough. The connection has to mean that we support them on a kind of a ladder. So if you live near a national park, you should have the chance to volunteer there. You should have a chance to go to a youth program. You should have a chance to do an internship there. And we're really trying to design and create that type of experience. So at the end of the day, if you choose to be a plumber, a doctor, a park ranger, whatever you choose to do, you have some connection in your mind and in your heart to conservation and public lands. So youth is definitely where it's at.
Chris, here's another question from the audience. What national park is most impacted by climate change, and how can we help mitigate those impacts as we enjoy and explore the parks?
Climate change is a big question, right? It's a big question for all of us. And how we measure the impacts directly associated with climate change in a park is not an easy task. A lot of the modeling that you see done by the International Panel on Climate Change and others is really at a fairly, it's a high scale. There's global modeling, and the landscapes that we deal with in parks are not that big. Probably the biggest parks we have, of course, are in Alaska. That's kind of our biggest laboratory for measuring. A park like Grand Canyon is about 2.1 million acres. But there's a lot that we're working with on the academic front to understand where those vulnerabilities are. And we've learned quite a lot. The most obvious impacts are in those parks with glaciers. You just photo points over the course of the last 80 years can tell you that those effects are real and those effects are changing the landscape. Another thing is in our parks that are in tropical settings, the island parks, where you see the elevation on those islands, the elevation, the sea level, is rising. It's a small example, but parking lots that were parking lots before that are now inundated year-round. So those are the kinds of things that we can see in parks. And we hope that parks can be a place not just of measuring climate change and understanding climate change from a laboratory perspective, if you will, but our goal in climate change for the National Park Service, when we get 300 million people a year who visit, is education, is to talk about climate change, is to go through that conversation that says climate change belongs to every one of us. And the better we understand it, the greater chance we're going to have for success in the future.
Here's another question from a student. I'm a student and Eagle Scout, wondering what youth can do to help maintain national parks and how do we motivate them to do so? Why should they care?
The single greatest thing any student can do in this room, Eagle Scout or Brownie, get a good education in science. Just take every course you can in science. Science explains the world. Science makes you a better citizen. Science makes you a better voter, a better mom, a better sibling, a better waitress. Because you can explain the world around you and you can answer your own curiosities. So in my opinion, the more you can convert people to the world of science so that they can understand what's around them, the more that transformative experience changes the lives of every individual, and nobody's smarter about it than youth. And nobody runs the world better than third graders. Seriously, that's the only reason we recycle, right? The recycling works because 20 years ago, third graders were like, Dad, if you throw that can away, you're in big trouble. You shouldn't throw that can away. Do you know you should recycle glass? Recycle glass. That's what changes the world. It's that perspective.
This is a really great question. How do we deal with us loving our parks to death? Yeah.
So the Find Your Park campaign increased visitation in almost every park in the country, which is great. Because we have to have people in nature to understand it. You might imagine that park rangers were nervous last year when Pokemon Go got popular. Right? Upside, they're outdoors. They're looking for things in nature. Downside, there are things in nature you can trip over. You know? And so if you think about the relevance of outdoors and that experience, you know, that connection is just so deep. Whether we can get it through a virtual experience and not visiting the park where you don't wait in as long a line, or coming to the park, we think it's an important experience. And when you see increased visitation, from an insider's perspective in the Park Service, we get really concerned that the bathrooms aren't clean enough, the trails are too crowded, there's too long a wait to get into a park. All of those things just seem terrible to us. And you know, we get to live in the park, and so we kind of see that change with the seasons. And interestingly, we've done some social science, in particular at Yellowstone, they've done social science. They've had a tremendous increase in visitation, in international visitation. And where I might say an experience went from a 97 to a 54 because of overcrowding and everything else, incredibly, the visitor reports their experience went from a 97 to a 94. I'm in a park. I'm with my family. I'm on vacation. I'm having a great time. I kind of have to wait, and the coffee's not that wonderful. But it's this perception that we are so much more concerned in the park as the park managers than the public seems to be. And a part of what we do in parks, you know, quite honestly, like lift the curtain, we keep most people on paved areas. If you go to Yellowstone National Park, 98% of the people are on 2% of the park. And if you're the 2% of the people who get off the trails, it's 98% clear. So part of what we do is we manage people for people's sake.
I have a nice stack of questions now.
Wow.
About financing parks. I don't want to read every single one of them, so I'll apologize, but there are a lot of questions about the future of funding, about what might happen under a new administration. Do you want to just generally talk a little bit about that? There are a couple of questions about nonprofit support, non-federal support, so maybe you could just address the larger question of funding.
I'd be happy to. So about 2 years ago, for the first time, the Park Service's budget went over $3 billion. Now, $3 billion buys a lot of some things and not very much of others. For the Park Service, it goes a long way. It gives us the opportunity. Most of our funds go into our staff, our personnel. And we have special projects where we're doing things like repaving roads, you know, that sort of thing. You may have heard that there's a $12 billion backlog in national parks of our assets. And that means things like historic lodges or trails or roads that are in disrepair. Now, that's probably not that out of the ordinary compared to urban areas where we've seen the same thing. We've seen it with bridges. And so we know that there may be an opportunity for us to improve some of that based on what has been floated as an infrastructure initiative under the current administration. We would certainly welcome that. It would certainly be an opportunity for us to make some improvements there. And we have to have enough people in parks to be able to oversee those projects. So if a 12% cut comes in the budget, it's going to be hard to juggle those two things. It's going to be hard to make those two things work. But if you've worked long with the federal government, the executive branch, you know that when a president proposes a budget, it's just that. It's a proposal. And the power of the purse is in the Congress. And so we'll see what happens next with the Congress. Our continuing resolution ends on April 28th. We all hope to be open on April 29th. That's what everybody wants to come to work. And that said, we don't have a crystal ball for the future. I would tell you that I've only been with the Park Service 10 years, and we haven't had a normal budget cycle in those full 10 years where we actually have a budget on October 1st, which is when the fiscal year begins. So I can't tell you how I would compare the current budget process with the past, because it's been different every year. We've had continuing resolutions or omnibus bills. And so I await alongside you with eager anticipation to see what happens. Now, the nonprofit side, this is totally awesome. And I think the reason the president could donate his quarterly salary to the Park Service is we actually have authority under law to accept donations. And I'm not taking them tonight. But we also have the authority to have nonprofits who work on our behalf to raise money. Often they operate the bookstores in parks. They're rarely operated by the National Park Service. They're almost always what we call a friends group or a cooperating association. And for me, coming to the National Park Service 10 years ago, it was quite a shock. I just did not know that that happened. And I came from the Environmental Protection Agency, where nobody raises money for you. There is no nonprofit raising money for the EPA. And I remember walking into the office and somebody said, oh, well, we're going to do this and we're going to use the money from our nonprofit. I'm like, wait, back up. A nonprofit supporting the federal government? But indeed, they do. And what they really are able to do is give us that margin of space or excellence that we need in things like education programs. There's no line item in the Park Service's budget that says you're going to provide education programs for youth, but we need it. And it's a place that makes a difference. So these partners are across the country working in different parks, making a huge difference in what we can do with the resources we have.
So one of the questions specifically asks, if someone's interested in donating, what's the best place or the best way to do this?
The Grand Canyon Association. I can get you that information like that. We actually have a national park partner called the National Park Foundation. And as a part of the centennial, they set a campaign to raise $300 million for parks across the country. And I'm happy to report they accomplished that, and they're extending that into 2017 to try to raise $500 million. So they're kind of the big picture, you know, fix the Washington Monument when it goes down. But you can also find a park locally. I'm sure Rocky Mountain National Park has a friends group, and they would be more than happy to tell you what they're trying to raise funds for to support the park.
So this is still a little bit around financial questions, but a couple of questions have come in. One from a student: how do we prevent our parks from becoming too commercialized and make sure we keep them the most natural and down-to-earth that we can? And a related one about the concession profits and how does that go to park management?
Okay, let's take the first question first. So the National Park Service, the great thing about the National Park Service is our mission is recorded in law. So whatever vagaries may come to us over the course of any given time period, every park has a law that establishes it for the singular national significance that it was created. Grand Canyon, big hole in the ground. Yellowstone, big geysers. Because those are such unique national features. There's also three laws that help us nationally. One's called the Organic Act in 1916. It created the National Park Service. And those are real anchors for us. And you read those through and you understand that the policy of the National Park Service is predominant in our responsibility to steward our resources, protect our heritage, make sure our cultural resources are preserved, and that our natural resources are managed into perpetuity. And then on this side as a secondary is public use. So when we make decisions for the long-term public interest with the best available sound science, we use accurate fidelity to law to make sure this side, which is the non-commercial side and the protection of our resources, is always predominant. And that's a part of what helps us manage and say, if you're going to have a commercial use in a park, it's only because we've asked you to help us provide that experience for the visitor. Could be guided raft trips, could be camping trips, could be fishing trips. You know, we have lodges in parks. Those are run by concessioners and not by the National Park Service. But I would tell you, we're not bad fiscal managers because we managed to get a cut out of all those profits. And that's important.
several questions about the oil and gas development potential in both the Grand Canyon and in other areas, questions about fracking in national parks. Do you want to address some of those questions?
Not particularly.
Natural resources and...
But thanks anyway. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, moving right along.
You know, when a national park is established, it's established because it has some type of national significance. But sometimes there's a trade-off in the actual legislation. So, for example, Padre Island National Seashore, there's a certain amount of oil and gas development that has always been allowed there and will be allowed there because it's written into the law. So it's something that's built in or baked into that park's existence. The piece that we fall back on when there's new development proposed in or around a national park is that within our requirements under law, we cannot allow impairment in parks, period. We cannot allow impairment in parks. So if something happens that's not reversible, we're not allowed to let it happen. And we're even allowed and encouraged to work outside the park boundaries to make sure we get involved early and address those issues that we think could impact the park. So at Grand Canyon, for example, we're involved in proposed uranium mining. We want to protect the night skies around the park. We want to make sure we've got water quality and quantity that are necessary, not so that we can have people in the park, but so the seeps and springs in that canyon can continue forever. So those are all three things or four things that are threats outside the park that we're deeply involved in to try to prevent harm and hopefully have early engagement and an opportunity on that decision making. This is like a card game. It's like poker over here.
I know.
You should see what's going on.
I'm looking for patterns here. So actually, there's a very interesting question from an advertising student, one of my students. The question is, how will the use of communication affect the longevity of the national parks and National Park Service? And I think it goes hand in hand with an earlier question that I read from the, well, I didn't read it. I read it to myself. From someone asking about some of the social media challenges that the National Park Service has experienced. Maybe you could talk about both of those together.
So the 11 billion impressions that we got probably weren't all from inside parks. Because if you've been in a park and you have a device, often there's not much connectivity, right? Good or bad? What if you're working there and your family's not there? What if you're in the middle of an emergency and you'd like a helicopter to come and get you? So it's good and bad, right? Like most things, it's good and bad. But one of the things that we know is often parks, particularly the big Western parks, are at the end of the block when it comes to getting utilities, when it comes to getting communications. And every park that is undergoing this transition to a wireless community does planning around it. The Park Service is really, really good at planning. When I first came to the Park Service, I thought, wow, they're really intentional in thinking about that. So under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, when you take a federal action that involves funding, it involves, for example, putting up a wireless tower, we do a study on that, and we really invite a lot of public participation. So if you have a park where you have a concern around the development, there's an opportunity for you to be involved. But I have to tell you, some Park Service traditionalists just don't want anything to do with social media, and I'm not one of those. I think if we can get kids and youth and a connection into parks, the park will start to speak for itself, and they'll start to look away from their devices. And they might change their pace of life just a little bit. And then later they can tweet their friends about it.
Wow, this is a good follow-up to that answer, actually. Someone said, I go to Rocky Mountain National Park to hike in the wilderness and get away from the city. With the growth in Front Range population, it's crowded and busy. Lots of bad behavior, illegal camping, dogs on the trail, drones, music played on cell phones as people hike by me. Bottom line, our wilderness is being lost to technology and illegal behavior. What can be done to get back to a simpler wilderness experience? And this is similar to several other questions about overcrowding, and do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the Park Service is really struggling with this because one of the things we know is that the visitor experience is critical. You know, when you walk through Muir Woods in California, Northern California, it's like a cathedral of old redwood trees, and you don't particularly want blaring noise. You don't particularly want to have your experience disrupted. So does that experience get disrupted when there are 10 people around you or 50 or 100? We don't know. And so what we're starting to do is really gather social science on this and try to understand within the context of wilderness or front country, paved trails, backcountry trails. What is that experience like for people? What is their expectation first as they come in? And as they have the experience, what is it like? One person's overcrowding is another person's comfort, which is amazing to me. They don't want to be on a trail where there aren't other people. They don't want to be in the backcountry where they might have to go more than 100 feet for water. And that's a choice, right? And what the Park Service is trying to do is thread that needle and say, how many experiences can we have of what type, for which people, when? And at the end of the day, it's likely going to mean limiting the number of visitors in parks, or at least having certain park experiences. And that is a tough call. You know, in the democratic notion of these parks are available for all, for people to do, if you follow a few simple rules, it's hard to say we're only going to have so many people doing so many things. We already limit the number of river trips down the Colorado River. We limit that so that they're not overcrowded. And in some places, communities say, darn right, limit it. You know, there's just too many folks coming in. In other places, people say, I only get one chance to go there, and you're telling me now that I can't, and I've saved a lifetime. So it's a big balancing act we're going to have to walk down.
Here are a couple of questions, excuse me, about water issues. One says, are you still doing the big spring flush of high water in the Grand Canyon, and what have the ecological impacts been? And a second one from a student asking about water issues related to national parks and what we can do to conserve water and minimize the effects of climate change on rivers, lakes, and oceans. So sort of granular and then a bigger picture part of the water issue.
So the Colorado River, as you know, used to flow unimpeded through the Grand Canyon. And then a dam got put up. And then another dam got put up. And so now we're constrained on either end. And we know that when you have a river that's flowing naturally, you have high flows and low flows, and you have scouring flows, and you have flows that erode and flows that deposit. And that system doesn't happen now because the waters are controlled. But the good news is we've worked hard to create opportunities to try to replicate those flows at least on some scale. And so at Grand Canyon National Park over the last 6 years, we've done five, so one year we missed, what are called high flow experiments, where we have the Glen Canyon Dam release a high flow for about 72 hours, and that is meant to essentially serve that same natural function that you would have had, you know, year-round with different flows from snowpack and stuff. And we're seeing some good results. It's mixed. It's varied. Sometimes when we build sandbars as a result of those flows, they stay around for a little while, but not as long as they otherwise would. One of the things we know is we have a threatened and endangered fish. We have three different species of threatened and endangered fish. And a part of the job of the hydropower industry is to not extirpate those fish. So high flows and the high flow experiments are a part of that. And we're learning more each time we do them. And as the National Park Service, we hope to be able to continue doing them. The big water picture question. Ask me that one again.
About climate change and how the impact on the national parks and how we can address issues that are related to that.
So it's been a big winter. Big winter in Colorado? Has it been out of the drought? No. Now, yeah. Yes and no. I can see that from you all now. See how this happens? You're all watching the same, you know, information, but your perception is different around water. Because water in the West is such an attention-getting topic, right? And so when you think about Colorado River water, there's a certain amount of water in the Colorado River that runs from Estes Park, and it runs out south of here, you know, south of the border, and it's way over-allocated, right? We've committed that money to water to way more acre feet than is actually available. And there are about 14 national parks affected by that. So what we're trying to do from the national park perspective is get those parks all together, do some research, do some education, rather than one park at a time as pearls on a necklace, working together to educate people in the West about water, to try to make sure that water conservation practices are in place in every park, and to just try to demonstrate and be the example for people who come to parks to understand, just like we are for climate change. You know, the Park Service, we know where we stand on climate change, and our biggest opportunity really is in the education.
Again, several questions are related to the issues of transferring federal lands to state ownership. And some very specific questions about places like Bears Ear National Monument. Would you be able to talk about that issue and the most effective way to fight legislators who want to reverse the protected status of these areas?
We'll do a little bit of civics. So I work in the executive branch, and the President Obama designated 29 national monuments by executive order. So rather than through the Congress, 29 monuments, not all Park Service, some are Fish and Wildlife Service, I'm sorry, some are Forest Service, some are BLM. And my understanding is that the Antiquities Act, which gives the president the authority to designate monuments, gives the authority to designate but not to withdraw. So the first reading that I've gotten from our solicitors at the Department of the Interior feels pretty good on that front. Now, can Congress change the Antiquities Act? Of course. Congress can change any law they see fit to repeal, replace, reveal, refresh, whatever they want to do with that. So what I would tell you around Bears Ear National Monument is, at the end of the administration, there were kind of two monuments sitting in front of President Obama. One was the Grand Canyon National Monument, which would have expanded area around Grand Canyon, and he chose to go with Bears Ear. I think the reason he chose to go with Bears Ears was this amazing coalition of tribes. And that involvement that includes the representation of traditional ecological knowledge, the culture that comes with the landscape that is aboriginal for those tribes, was just such a critical and important decision. And I hope that people will work hard to understand the nature of the decision and why it's important, not just from a conservation legacy, but from a cultural legacy.
First of all, I want to say, as we're nearing the last 5 minutes of our time together, there are a bajillion awesome questions on this app, so thank you to everyone. There's no way we're going to get to all of them, so I apologize to anyone whose great question we can't complete. But let me ask a couple more. One person says, I've read that minorities visit the parks less than whites. If this is true, what are you doing to address this?
Well, I believe that it is true. And the reason I believe that is there have been some really interesting studies that have come out of San Francisco State University around diversity or lack of diversity in national parks. And it's not an easy fix. I think there are a lot of cultural lessons the National Park Service needs to learn. The National Park Service, which is 82% white in our employment, reflects the people that visit national parks. It's really interesting. There's a lot of parallels there. So we need to change our organization from the inside out so that people of color will feel welcome in national parks. I was talking to a friend Sunday morning who said that she was having dinner with a couple of her pals, and one of them said, my people don't go outdoors. And we explored that a little bit. And he said, you know, I don't invite bears into my living room to eat pizza and drink beer. I am not going to their living room. Let's just agree that our living rooms are separate. But that is the story that his family has told for years, that the outdoors is dangerous. And we're not going to overcome that other than working and building confidence in people to be in the outdoors. Whether it's a cultural issue or an urban issue or a suburban issue, the question is whether or not the outdoors moves you, and whether or not you have the opportunity to get the outdoors in a meaningful way to see if it does or if it will.
Lightning round?
Ready to go.
Okay.
Three.
What about the rumored tram?
Yellow. Oh, that wasn't it. Sorry.
No, actually, that's the question.
What yes, about the I'm thinking
tram?
About it. I think probably, and somebody can clarify for me, there is a proposal by the Navajo Nation to build a project called the Escalade, which is a tram that would go from Navajo land on the south rim of the Grand Canyon down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Is an amazing tourist development opportunity for them. They see it economically, the developer does. And there's a proposal to put that in as right at the confluence of the Little Colorado River and the Colorado River, which is a very sacred site for many tribes. And the Park Service has weighed in, is listening, is watching other tribes, and we would be disappointed to see a project like that go on. And our current position is that the project as proposed would actually end on Park Service lands, and so we would never allow that. So that's kind of the policy hook that we have. But interestingly, all of the tribes in the surrounding area, there are 11 tribes associated with the Grand Canyon, they have all asked the Navajo Nation to withdraw any proposal for that. And each of the committees in the Navajo tribal government, there are four committees that are voting on this proposal. Three of the four have voted it down, and then probably later this year it will go to the tribal council. So we'll be watching and weighing in.
Any chance the national parks will change policy with regard to dog visitors?
So that's such an interesting question, and this is lightning round. So dogs are not actually visitors to park, but people are visitors to parks who sometimes bring dogs. That's how we interpret the policy right now. And in 417 park units. In 416, if you bring your dog, you have to have it on leash if it's going to be in the areas where a dog is allowed. In only one place, which is Golden Gate National Recreation Area, are you allowed to bring a dog off leash in certain designated areas. And that park is currently facing review of a regulation that it's proposed, and we will see how that turns out. But my guess is it's probably not going to open the door for other parks.
I think I can read this. I heard the Golden Age Pass. What is that?
Golden Age Pass.
Pass.
If you're 62 or over, you get a lifetime pass.
Cost was going up.
It is.
I paid $10 17 years ago. It was
Lucky.
A wonderful pass.
Good
What's
for you.
The cost now?
$80.
Ouch.
It's the rest of your life, please. Americans are living to be like 100. There's no better bargain. Please.
This might be the last question.
This man's
Chris.
Bidding 100. What else do we have? How do we go? How do we go? How do we go?
These are two great questions. I'm going to put them together. One says, what's your favorite place? And one says, what's your favorite park? Give us the inside.
Oh, see, you're never supposed
why.
To answer that question. I was the regional director in the Pacific West, where there are 61 national parks. And every time I went to a park, they said, what's your favorite national park? And what you're supposed to do if your politic is lie. And you're supposed to say, whatever park I'm in, which is so unsatisfying, right? That is just totally unsatisfying. So my favorite national park is Mesa Verde National Park.
Yeah.
It's my memory. You know, so I was little, like 5 years old, and went to Mesa Verde with my family. And I remember almost nothing of the cliff dwellings because I was little and they were big and they were far away and my attention span was short. But I remember the dioramas with the little tiny people in them in the museum. Little tiny dogs and little grinding stones. So Mesa Verde, hands down.
So the last question. Reflect a little bit on your personal philosophy and what led you to this work of protecting America's wild lands.
You know, when I grew up, I spent a lot of time in the outdoors. And it wasn't so much focused on parks. It was focused just on the outdoors. And it was the day when it was a rough and tumble, go out in the play in the Highline Canal, and your parents really didn't know where you were, but you were probably going to show up before it got too dark. And, you know, there wasn't the age of stay in the backyard and make sure the gate is locked. And so for me, I just had the opportunity to have that experience that kept me happy. It kept me connected. It was the ability to kind of pursue that passion that is almost never parallel with your career. I think it's pretty rare that you get to take your passion and your career and the Western United States and make a life out of them. So, you know, the biggest part to that for me is that connecting other people to that experience of our heritage that is so unique and the memories that get created has become more important to me than the landscapes I see and the landscapes where I live. It's about the people who are moved. It's the nostalgia and the novelty of a grandparent and a grandkid coming to a park together and sharing an experience that they're just never going to forget. So to me, it's become more about the people than the place, but don't leave the places out of the equation, and you can donate now.
Will you join me in thanking Chris Leonards for this wonderful presentation?
Thank you.